Michael, let's start with the conflict in Ukraine and what we're witnessing right now in Ukraine. It seems that the West is trying to drag on this conflict and continue this conflict in Ukraine. When you look at the current face of the war and you see the policy of Europeans together with the United States in Ukraine, what's your understanding? What's your take on this?
I think the key factors or the key considerations that take into place are these. One, Ukraine clearly is losing the war in military terms. I mean, they're still fighting tenaciously with the means and the manpower they have, but their fate is sealed for objective reasons. In regard to the battlefield, it's simply a question of how it's going to end and when. True, the West is desperate. Desperate because the West, led by the United States, has invested enormous amount in what we might call the Ukraine project. It's never been entirely or even mainly about Ukraine. You know, the current war is a culmination of a 10-year-old, or if you want to go back, 2008 campaign to enlist Ukraine in NATO and to, in effect, sort of surround Russia, not simply in physical military terms, but the hope and the purpose was to marginalize Russia, marginalize it from European affairs, and to hope that the regime introduced on the set of policies introduced by Mr. Putin when he came to power, succeeding a Boris Yeltsin in 2000, the end of 1999, would revert back to what they'd been before. That is, not only Western friendly and Western dependent, but in effect becoming a dependage of the West. The reasons for this and the importance attached to keeping Russia weak and marginalized are several. Some of them are highly irrational, strategic. Some are historical in origin. Some emotional. But let's concentrate just in summary on the strategic one. We get the American policymakers since 1990. 91, with the collapse of this and this disintegration of the Soviet Union, have been really following the playbook that was sort of laid out in detail by Paul Wolfowitz in his notorious memo of March 1991, in which this was a sort of bold and audacious sort of plan to not only maintain American hegemony. And he spoke about it in quite literal terms, both realpolitik, power balance terms, and also in terms of economic and soft power as well. And the prescription for doing so was to keep, to ensure that there would be no challenger to American supremacy, even if this entailed taking preventive, and let's differentiate between preventive and preemptive action. We understand the difference in military terms. In political, diplomatic, strategic terms, it simply meant that the United States should use all of the means and instruments of influence at its disposal to prevent any state from acquiring the assets, the strength by which it could challenge American hegemony. We see that operative at the moment in regard to sort of China, which poses no military threat except the United States, but an existential one in the true sense of the word. China is a threat to the United States because it exists as what it is. In the case of Russia, the policy since 1991, and which has taken on new focus and meaning under Putin, is to prevent Russia from acquiring the sort of strength or anything approximating the strength that China has, so that it would not become a factor on the international scene an independent autonomous factor that would be a stone in the shoe of the U.S., to use a mafia term. So that's the kind of back. That was the in the Ukraine project really took shape and particular form in 2014. And that project was to not only to have Ukraine enter NATO and serve as a forward base for NATO, but it was to weaken Russia. And the ultimate goal of certainly the Biden administration has been not only to secure Ukraine's membership in NATO, not only to secure it as a base for NATO military equipment, but regime change in Moscow. And you and I might consider to be this to be utterly unrealistic, if not absurd, but it is very much on the agenda of the people who are shaping policy under Biden, including Biden himself. And that was the ultimate goal of the Ukraine project. Now, of course, it's disintegrating. On the battlefield, also Russia is stronger than it's ever been. The Putin regime is more stable and secure than it's ever been. And yes, Russia has been severed from the West, but Russia as a factor in the international power equation, regionally certainly, but even globally, has been greatly enhanced. So they're not prepared to simply shut the books on this chapter and to seek a peaceful resolution that would necessarily mean the neutralization of a rump Ukraine and admission of defeat on the battlefield, but would be a jeopardize, not just jeopardizing, but relinquishing the goals and objectives of this sort of American grand strategy. So they don't know what to do, which is why they're contemplating these rather extreme ideas of now inflicting so much damage on Russia that this would lead them, or lead Putin and his team, to accept a deal on Ukraine that would not be as onerous from the West perspective as otherwise it is likely to be.
At this stage of war in Ukraine, they're talking about training Ukrainians, even Boris Johnson, inviting Azov battalion, talking about let's give them attackums, let's send money, let's send ammunition to Ukraine, let's fight more. And at the same time, you see Emmanuel Macron talking about training Ukrainians. When you look at this behavior of European Union, of European leaders, let's assume
you're... It's reaching for straws. And of course, the particular items you mentioned of new training, you know, new equipment, new armaments, an increase in a handful of military personnel from the West, $68 billion. None of this is going to have much of an effect on the battlefield, as people far more conversant about the subject than I all agree. The new factor or the new item on the agenda is this growing consensus in Washington and in European capitals that they should expand the number of and the variety of missiles that they have been sending to Ukraine, so as to, one, extend their reach deeper into Russia proper, and to then, use that capability so as to inflect sites within Russia that Russia considers to be of high value, like these two radars have been attacked, and one of which some minor damage was inflicted, the other missed or failed. And they have those assets are important to Russia, not in regard to Ukraine. Those are over the horizon radars as part of Russia's and originally Soviet Union system of detecting incoming intercontinental missiles from the United States. So this is a very, very serious matter as far as the Russians are concerned. And the connection to Ukraine is that the Biden administration and the European allies, vassals, whatever we want to call them, are raising the stakes and taking an enormous gamble and saying that we're prepared to accept the possibility of serious Russian retaliation and the escalation that this would represent in the hope that we can impose such costs on Russia that they would lead them to accept an end to hostilities with forces in place, freezing of them, and leaving a significant part of Ukraine, if not all of what it was 2 years ago, as an autonomous independent state that then would be welcomed into NATO. That's what they're hoping. I mean, it's another bit of pie in the sky wishful thinking, I and most other people believe, but it's a sign of the desperation, the fact that they've run out of ideas, and the fact that they are deeply unwilling to accept defeat of this project in which they've invested so much.
The biggest loser of this conflict in Ukraine is Ukraine. And the second loser of this war is the European Union. And the problem here is why the European Union is so insistent in continuation of this war. This war has damaged the economy of Europe, but it doesn't seem that these European leaders have any sort of understanding on what's going on, or they don't care what's going on in Europe. They mostly care about what the United States is thinking of them as European leaders. Are they really thinking that they are insignificant? That's why they're trying to be closer to the United States.
It's a very important question, and it is baffling, frankly. There are some things we know, and that is for the last, close to 80 years now, Europe, or the main countries of Europe, the old Western Europe, if you like, have been in a classic dominant subordination relationship with the United States, which entails not just sort of physical dependence, security, but psychological dependence. And these countries have had for generations now really no political will and no desire to achieve any degree of substantial autonomy and leverage on world affairs. Rather quite willing and in psychological terms, behavioral terms, I would say, unable to cut loose from the United States. So that's a very, very important more than contextual foundation element. I think second has to do with the peculiar characteristics of contemporary European political leadership. I mean, to put it bluntly, these are small bore politicians with little strategic vision. And they also I'd be prepared to say, people with some degree of insecurity as regard to their own performance matching up to their self-image, like that would be true of Mr. Macron, who has a grand conception of himself, but is not in a position to, in effect, realize it in any meaningful and tangible way. So he spouts all kinds of ideas or notions, whatever, however tenuous the connection to reality. Then you raise a question. I mean, clearly Europe is a loser. I mean, their economies have been dealt a body blow by the severing of ties, mainly energy, but also other forms of ties with Russia. They're all in the doldrums. All of the economic forecasts is they are losing a competitive edge, and therefore will be victims of very slow growth, if not total stagnation, for at least, a decade. None of the current leaders are popular. If you look at all of the leaders in Europe, I think all of them, but certainly all of the major countries and those at the western end of the continent, their popularity ratings are low, below 50%. Many of them, like Macron's in the 20s. Schultz in Germany, I think, is sort of similarly. The conservative government, Tory government in Britain, is about to be forced to pack its bags and leave. And you're right, they don't seem to be terribly concerned about what the course of action or passive action has meant in terms of its impact on the citizenry. Not only in economic terms, but in terms of instilling in large segments of the population a lack of confidence and respect in governmental institutions and in political class, which is a phenomenon which is pronounced in the United States as well. And what that does, of course, is it opens the way for all kinds of adventurers and radical parties, as you see appearing, neo-fascist parties in Europe, to exploit the sort of free-floating discontent and to make an appearance on a political scene, and now participating in government in the Netherlands, as they did in Austria some years ago. But people with very limited vision and more concerned about their own position, status, etc., rather than the responsibilities of office and the custodial role which they'd be expected to perform to the welfare of their citizens, fail to recognize this. And the result is what you see now.
We know that Zelensky's terms is over right now. He's not anymore the official, as Russian are insisting that they're not considering Zelensky as the official president of Ukraine because his term has finished on May 20th. And right now, the Western countries, European, together with the United States, are talking about that they are considering Zelensky as the president of Ukraine. If the West decides to go after some sort of political settlement for this conflict in Ukraine, Zelensky would be a proper option to be in power in Ukraine.
You know, I mean, Zelensky obviously has been written off by the Russians. I mean, not only have they declared him now to be an illegitimate holder of office and say that the legal president of Ukraine, in keeping with the Ukrainian constitution, is the speaker of the Rada, of the assembly. They know that Zelensky is not someone with whom they could deal and who would be an interlocutor appropriate to reaching a peace settlement that would be acceptable to them. I think that letting things go and seeing how matters sort of develop. At the West, and particularly the American end, I think they've tied their fate to Zelensky, just as Zelensky has tied his fate to them. And it's been suggested, and this sounds plausible to me, that one reason why Zelensky has been able to ward off any challenges, so even no political challenges, really, because he suppressed the opposition entirely. But any was speaking of as any conceivable challenge from some member of the current government or from the military. One reason why he has seen them off and seem and appears to be secure at this point is that he's the conduit for all of the money and aid coming in to the country. And, you know, the notorious corruption of Ukraine in this way facilitates his retaining power, because the money comes through him and then he doles it out and in effect buys off everybody else, including apparently senior members of the military. And so if he goes, the conduit might disappear. It's been suggested that what the end game of this will be that eventually, as the army, which organizationally and institutionally it probably will not crack, but will acknowledge in practical terms their defeat, will eventually dispose of him, take over, simply because there's no other course of action except to remove the man who would be the impediment and is the impediment to any consolidation of what remains of the Ukraine, the Ukrainian state. So how long down the road that is probably will depend very much on what happens in the battlefield. And one would suspect the Russians, who know, of course, Ukraine inside and out, that's probably what they see as the most likely sort of a scenario. The one thing that could upset it, of course, is the sort of Western escalation of attacks on Russia, Russian and retaliation. And then we're in another game. And a much more dangerous and unpredictable game.
In your opinion, with the current phase of the war in Ukraine, is Russia interested in Odessa and Nikolaev? Odessa is so important for Ukraine and for Russia as well. How do you see this city that is so important? It's the connection of Ukraine to the Black Sea. At the same time, if Russia let this city in the hand of Ukrainians, they can use this city to attack Crimea. It's so important in many ways.
I think generally speaking, the Russian conception of the future for Ukraine is built on two or three sort of critical elements. The first is to ensure that Ukraine never again could pose a threat to Russia or could not be used as an instrument to threaten Russian security. That means there would have to be ironclad guarantees of its neutrality and its demilitarization. By demilitarization, one simply means ensuring that never again would it be armed, equipped, and organized the way it was after 2014. In territorial terms, I suspect that the Kremlin's notion as to what would be acceptable has changed over time. The territory itself, there's no natural barrier, if you like. And to prevent the Ukraine from ever again posing a threat to Russia depends on essentially political factor and Russia maintaining a dominant military position with regard to whatever rump state of Ukraine, sort of survives. But if the West is unprepared to negotiate accept that. And I think the West has still have Western leaders have an entirely unrealistic notion of how much of Ukraine they can preserve and how much autonomy such a Ukraine will have, and therefore what political relationship, much less civil security military relationship, it might have with the West. Totally unrealistic notions of this in Western capitals and especially in Washington. But at the end, the West's failure, inability to look realistically at these prospects means that the Russians probably will feel that they have to keep, will have to keep going westward in order to sort of drive the lesson home that there is no prospect, no possibility for the reconstituting a Ukraine that is hostile to to Russia, or that conceivably could be hostile to Russia and a threat to Russia in the future. And that doesn't mean, of course, occupying all of Ukraine, and Russians not interested in that. One suspects, given the intractable attitude of the West, that the Russians will wind up on the Dnieper, no matter how long it takes, you know, just moving step by step. We don't know whether there's going to be a big offensive or not. And if they do that, they'll probably also take Odessa, which after all, historically, was really a Russian city, and likely Kharkov. I call it Kharkov because that's where my maternal grandfather came from. He was chased out by the Okhrana, the old Russian Imperial Police, because he was associated as a very young man or boy as a courier for some, I don't know, revolutionary organization. When he came, he stopped speaking about those experiences. The only thing I remember is saying, when his father owned a shoe factory, or whatever you call a big manufacturing site, and my idealistic maternal grandfather picketed his own father's shoe factory when workers went out on strike. Anyway, not because I have any association with Kharkov, and why I call it Kharkov, I have no feelings about it whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, the Russians, given intractables, will probably wind up doing that. And in other words, incorporating one way or another Odessa and Kharkov. And that's, of course, bad news for Ukrainians, who've already paid this astronomical price for what is a Western adventure. I mean, don't forget, when Zelensky ran for president, he ran on a conciliation with Russia peace platform. And before 2014, large majorities of Ukrainians in survey poll were unfavorable and opposed to Ukraine joining NATO. And so that would, there was no overwhelming tide of public sentiment for either the country joining NATO, much less fighting Russia in order to attain that objective. That is something that's been nurtured and fostered over time and was a part of the Western-defined Ukraine project, which was really a Russia project.
Michael, in your opinion, who's Putin to Russia? What's your take on Putin as the president of Russia? Since 2000, he was in power, and literally everything was, during all these years, he was in charge of Russia. And if you were to explain who's Putin, in your opinion, who's Putin?
You're referring to Putin's rise and consolidation?
I'm talking about how do you find Putin as the leader of Russia? How did you find him all these years that he was in power in Russia?
Well, I mean, Putin's an extraordinary man. I mean, the West doesn't want to acknowledge this. I mean, he is the most remarkable political leader and statesman of this century. And you can go back a long ways into history, in fact, finding his equal. I mean, you look what the man has accomplished, man. He took a state, which had been truncated, right? Which was in dire straits, in which life expectancy had dropped by 8 years, in which tens of millions have been impoverished, in which all public institutions have been degraded, many of which were no longer functioning, in which the country had been prey to Western, predatory economic interests, extracting control, gaining control over Russian natural resources and so on and so forth. I mean, that was the Yeltsin legacy. And then this man comes out of the seemingly nowhere, Putin, and within not that many years, reconstituted Russia, reconstituted it politically, in terms of state institutions, in terms of economically, and doing so in military terms, right? So Russian weapon systems are superior, not across the board, but generally demonstrated to be superior and more sophisticated in technological terms than anything the United States has. We don't have supersonic missiles, for example, and other things as well. I mean, even our great Abrams tank proved to be totally ineffectual in terms of the kind of warfare that was conducted. So anyway, I mean, the man's accomplishments are enormous. He's also extremely adroit diplomatically, extremely adroit politically. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, it doesn't mean I necessarily agree with everything he's done, or believe that he has not restricted political liberties in Russia more than was necessary or desirable, right? Although Russia is a much freer place than it's depicted in the West, of course. I mean, we have a cartoon vision of Russia just as we have a cartoon vision of Putin. But I think one of the reasons why Western leaders also hate the man, so, right, and try their best to belittle him. And this goes back, by the way, to Barack Obama's days. Barack Obama really does hate him, and in his memoirs says the most ridiculously insulting and denigrating things about Putin. And I think there's a somewhat simple reason for that, and Putin is obviously superior to them. He's superior in intellect, he's superior in knowledge. I mean, look at the range of subjects in which he has a masterful knowledge, which he puts on display in speeches and press conferences. When you have someone like Biden who can hardly get three straight sentences together, and none of them can speak on substantive matters with the fluency and articulateness of Putin. And so he's more intelligent than they are. He's superior diplomatic and political skill. He's much more poised than they are. And that on top of what he's done in terms of putting Russia back on the chessboard of Europe and the world as a major player is why they hate him so. And that's a very, very serious obstacle to dealing with him on anything like realistic, potentially fruitful terms. And I thought, we have no diplomacy. The United States has no diplomacy whatsoever. We talk much more with the Soviet leadership than we do with Putin or Lavrov or anyone else in Russia. And the same for the West Europeans. And when they do venture to meet him, you know, like Macron does, or so, they make fools of themselves. They become, you know, objects of ridicule, and appropriately so. So, I mean, not only do you have strategic, conceptual reasons why the West is unable to accommodate themselves to the realities of Russia, I think you also have psychological and personal one. And that's clearly, it's more than unfortunate, it might have tragic consequences.
When Putin came to power in 2000, he was literally pro-Europeans. He wanted to have a better relationship with European countries, with the United States. And it's all gone right now. Who's responsible for this disaster that is happening right now? And what was the reason behind this type of ridiculous and disastrous policies?
Well, the West is responsible. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, Putin clearly expressed the desire to have Russia, you know, live together with the rest of Europe in sort of a harmonious fashion. Remember, he used the term partner, referring to Western European states and governments, up until 2.5 years ago. Up until the Biden administration made clear that it wished him ill and out of office. He was not a westernizer in the tradition of Russian historical tradition in terms of preferring the West over Russia. No, he always had a clear notion of Russian identity character, but he didn't see this at all irreconcilable with having very constructive relations across the board with the West and with the major countries of, you know, of Western Europe. But he was rebuffed at every turn. In fact, he's, from what I'm told by people who follow Russian affairs and knowledgeable about Russia and read Russian, is that he is severely criticized for this, certain, you know, in Russian political circles, going back to, you know, the 2000s, 2008, and it took on more, the criticism took on more point, right? as American-led Western hostility towards Russia became more and more tangible through the 2010s, and these people would criticize him for not responding, not reacting with sufficient, you know, force. And there are even critics of the way he was conducting the war, at least. Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
In the early, sorry, we had an
no problem.
Back in the early phases. And people in Russia would say, well, all the attention is focused on the opposition from his opponents, we call them the Westernizers, or the Democrats, if you want to look at it more positively, in a way, that their influence has always been exaggerated in Russian politics. They've gotten enormous support, financial as well as otherwise, from the West, of all these NGOs. But really, it was Russian nationalists who constituted more of a, not necessarily a direct political, but let's say policy intellectual challenge to Putin than the supposedly, you know, Western-oriented Moscow and Petersburg you know, intelligentsia. And, you know, another feather in Putin's cap is his ability to foster a cultivate a consensus based on a certain conception of Russia, which is sort of, you know, distinctly Russian, but not adverse or towards anybody else, whether it be, you know, the West or the rest of the world. It's just a Russia that would set its own path domestically and would act independently, but not aggressively internationally. And then you look at that's evident in the approval rating. But around 80, you have around 80%, which is double the approval ratings of Joe Biden, and more than double of the approval ratings of Schultz and Macron and Sunak, whose ratings are so low that if you had the three together, they wouldn't come close to Putin's.
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah, four. And if you look at right now, we had Anthony Blinken, Janet Yellen, Olaf Scholz, they went to China to convince Xi not to help Russia. And right after that, we had this visit of Putin to China, which was so different in many ways and was so unbelievably strange, because at the end of this visit, Xi embraced Putin. That was something unusual when it comes to the relationship between Russia and China. Many people are thinking that, why is that so important? Because we didn't see anything like this before. What's your take on this hugging, on this type of behavior on the part of Xi?
Well, historians will look back on this period and say, I mean, that's the greatest in historic accomplishment of the Biden administration and their predecessors. And that is bringing together Russia and China in an embrace which actually goes beyond alliance. Right? And the two have forged a relationship which is not really contingent or dependent on circumstance. It is likely to endure because they're knitting all kinds of ties, economic ties, joint projects of various sorts, joint sort of diplomatic undertaking, which also makes sense from their vantage point, because both of them are targeted by the United States, and in the United States is tow or train, the rest of the collective West. And they not only have to sort of defend themselves, okay, but they clearly see their long-term interest as requiring that they establish another node internationally in counterpoise to the American web of institutions and arrangements and relationships which constitute American hegemony. And they're making a lot of progress, not only because of their own endeavors and their own imaginative initiatives, but also so much of the rest of the world is getting fed up with being bullied by the United States. It's simply a manifest fact of life, right? Which people in Washington and other European capitals, don't appreciate. And by the way, I think that our friend Chas Freeman suggested we use the word node rather than pillar is well said. Because we're not talking about polls as such, even in conventional political terms. We're talking about structured relationships of depth, which have multiple strands to them. And it's the poverty of strategic thinking, cemented by willful ignorance among Western political elites, which, allows the publics generally and the political class in these countries to fail to appreciate what's going on, which is an extraordinary phenomenon.
The other thing that was so amazing on the part of the Biden administration and his foreign policy toward China, when Antony Blinken went to China and was forcing Chinese not to help Russia and Ukraine. And if there is somebody in this world who's more interested in Russia winning the conflict, the war in Ukraine, more than Putin, that would be Xi in China. Because he knows what's at stake for China if Russia loses the conflict in Ukraine. The next would be China in Taiwan. And why they're trying to do such a ridiculous act in political form, and they're trying to convince Chinese not to help Russia. China would love Russia win this war.
Well, I think here we have to, deconstruct or look at the many definitions of the word stupid. I mean, these people are behaving stupidly. It's not because they have low IQs, but for a complex set of personality and psychological and collective psychology, which figure really in the realm of psychopathology, like collective and individual, not to say that they are clinically crazy, right? But it is pathological. I mean, to act in a way that's so illogical and contrary to your own well-being and interests and so forth. I mean, cannot explain simply in terms of poor judgment or bureaucratic pressures or electoral means or whatever. In fact, I mean, Biden and all of these guys are jeopardizing their own political and electoral futures by the way in which they're conducting or not conducting foreign policy. See, the hope in Washington was first that you could divide Russia and China by persuading Putin and the Russian leadership that if Russia got too close to China, China would dominate it, overwhelm it economically, financially, and demographically, if you like, right? That failed. So now they come up with this other bizarre idea you mentioned, and you try and convince China is not in their own self-interest to support Russia. Although the assertion that Russia critically depends upon technological armaments help from China is simply misplaced. It's not true. But once you live in a fantasy world the way the Biden people are now, then there's a certain consistency, a certain a building on those fantasies and thinking and doing things that conform to the fantasy world which you're inhabiting. In other words, you become disengaged from, so utterly disengaged from reality, right? That your individual actions make no sense and are disconnected as well. And the best, clearest example of that is what you referred to, Biden going off to China and said, stop helping Russia, otherwise We're going to impose greater sanctions. Well, sanctions cut both ways. And here there is a basic misunderstanding and misinterpretation of the consequences of China's extraordinary technological as well as manufacturing capabilities, and that we're not in a position to intimidate China by imposing further sanctions on top of those already have. It has been demonstrated with regard to, chips and microprocessor. We're hurting more than the Chinese are as a result of those sanctions that we're imposing, on them. And, the reaction of Xi and his associates was to say good riddance to you. A symbolic insult, Lincoln. Nobody accompanied him to the airport. He had to go in an embassy limousine. I don't think he had to call Uber because the embassy has limousine. But there wasn't a single official from the Chinese government, even from the lowest level, to bid him adieu. He was saying, the sooner you're out of here, the better. But we don't pick up on those signals. And they have a number of very complex but identifiable reasons for that in terms of the American collective psychology and self-image. But that's another story.
The military-industrial complex of the United States is gaining in this war because they're selling weapons to Ukraine. At the same time, European Union countries, they're sending their old weapons to Ukraine, and the military-industrial complex of the United States has to replace all these weapons. And they have two new customers, Sweden and Finland. That was a gain for the military-industrial complex of the United States.
Well, there is an industrial-military complex, and it does exercise a good deal of influence. And as my friend Ray McGovern has said, he has an acronym which I can't quite remember.
Mickey Mouse.
Much less pronounced. You might have heard it from him. He says it's an industrial-military think tank, academic, and I don't know what else. He has a fifth one in there. And it's true. But it's as much a mindset as it is direct influence. And it's true that these big defense industries, they have set a relationship on their own terms with the Defense Department, in good part because, they promise senior leaders cushy positions once they retire. They cultivate people in Congress by making large campaign donations. And one of the things they do when there's one of these multi-billion dollar projects, or in the case of the unfortunate F-35, I think it's going to wind up be $1 trillion to get, 200 planes that are only serviceable, usable 29% of the time. But anyway, they set up the manufacturing through subcontractors and subsidiaries, so that it's distributed among at least 40 states. And so you immediately have 80 senators who are going to be reaping some kind of electoral benefit. And of course, they also place them in the states of key senior members of the Senate Armed Services, not the Senate, the House Armed Services Committee and the House Appropriations Committee. So they exercise influence that way. So overall, you can say, yes, they're the second most influential lobby in Washington after the Israeli lobby. They count, but it's the degeneration of the whole foreign affairs community, the intellectual degeneration, right? inability to think in realistic in terms that conform to the realities of the world. And they're being locked into this very narrow consensus on the need, the compelling need to take drastic steps to maintain in unrealizable American global dominance and hegemony. That's really the fatal lapse in the system. I mean, you can't change direction unless you have some notion as to what the alternative is, and unless you break out of this sort of behavioral, psychological, intellectual box you're in, which is a fantasy world, and which excludes anything that might disturb it. And that's unfortunately, the real trap we've gotten ourselves into. And the Europeans, even to the same extent as we have. At least in the United States, you have some divergent voices. I mean, they're suppressed and they're unheard, except on shows like yours. They exist, they don't even exist. I know Europe quite well. They don't even exist in Britain. They don't exist you have some political opposition in France. They're not really intellectual opposition, except in a very loose ideological sense. Same in Germany, these people don't exist. The people on your show, their counterparts don't exist in Germany or Britain or France or Italy or in the Netherlands or in Sweden, in any of these places. So they're worse off even than we are, although there's a very thin rays of hope in the U.S. And you might have come to the realization that most of the people you have on who are part of this sort of informal community are quite elderly.